Right. Perfect. This is Carson Backus interviewing Mr. David Willoughby on June 13th, 2023 for the Minnesota Historical Society Tobacco Control Oral History Project. We're meeting at the Highland Park Library today. Thank you so much again for taking the time to meet with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
Perfect. Can we just start by you stating and spelling your full name, please, for the records?
David Willoughby, W-I-L-L-O-U-G-H-B-Y.
Thank you. Perfect. All right. Launching into maybe the first part of our questions, can you please tell me where and when you were born?
I was born in 1955, and I was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee. My parents were going to college in Tennessee, so that's where I was born.
Perfect. Can you tell me a little bit about your family growing up?
Sure. My parents, my father actually grew up part of his life in Venezuela, which ended up why he returned back to South America later on. My mother was from Ohio. My parents wanted to be missionaries, and so they went to what they call language school in Costa Rica. I was born I was about 6 months old when we went to Costa Rica. I actually started learning to speak English and Spanish at the same time. And so my parents were going to language school there, but actually because I had a Spanish-speaking nanny, so to speak, who stayed with me, I was learning as much Spanish as my parents were. And I was only a year and a half, and I was learning it at the English and Spanish at the same time. And so I continued that throughout my childhood and have remained fluent in Spanish. My parents went then from Costa Rica to Colombia in 1957. I was the only child at that time. My mother was pregnant, and a few months after we arrived in Colombia in 1957, my next brother, Tim, was born. I'm the oldest of five children. There are four boys and one girl. And so Tim was next, and then about 2.5 years later, my brother Dan, then my sister, and finally my youngest brother is 10 years younger than I am. So there are five of us kids. My father was trained in the ministry, and so he began working in Colombia. First, we started with oil company people in a small town called Tibú, and then later we moved around. My father would either teach or work on starting churches, but then about 1987 my father started working at a Bible Institute. He became an academic dean of a Bible Institute, and he then started teaching. And in Colombia, they don't have a great educational system. Okay. Most of the people, they do go to elementary school, so they go through the sixth grade. But very few of them go on to high school and then college. And so my father began to develop courses for what they consider low literacy, or somebody who had only had an elementary education. Mm-hmm. And so he would take courses that most of the time would be graduate level or seminary if you were preparing for ministry. Mm-hmm. He would take those kind of courses and he would make them into low literacy so people who only had an elementary education could understand it and then learn from it. Wow. So he became very good at that, became the academic dean of that Bible Institute, and taught there for over 15 years. My mom was pretty much a stay-at-home mom, but because they wanted us to be able to come back to the United States and do our education there, we went to a English-speaking boarding school in Venezuela.
Wow.
So we would go from Colombia to Venezuela. We spent about 7 months out of the year at that boarding school with breaks. I did my first grade here in the United States, but then I went back for second grade and left for boarding school. And when I left, because my birthday's in late October, I was only 6 years old when I left to go to boarding school.
Wow.
That was challenging. Yeah. That was hard. It was both hard for me and hard for my mom, especially my dad also, but my mom. But because it was English speaking, it had the American system, we continued to do that. And so all of us as kids went to boarding school. My mom was basically a stay-at-home mom until we all, were off to boarding school. And then she actually started teaching as well at the same Bible Institute where my father was.
Okay. Did all your siblings go to the same boarding school?
Yes, we did. Okay. Yep. So the boarding school actually went from first grade, actually had kindergarten. So kindergarten wow. through 12th grade.
Okay.
And it wasn't a large boarding school. We had at one point probably the largest was about 200. My graduating class in 1973 was the largest 10 people.
Oh my God.
It was the largest that had ever happened, and it was the largest for a couple of years after that.
Wow.
So it was a very small school. We did the normal things, that you do in a boarding school, but not a lot of people there.
Fair enough. Would you say, it was challenging, obviously, when you began it. Looking back, did you appreciate your time at boarding school? Do you wish you had?
I mean, here's what it was hard for me, especially because I was first one. I then sort of became a parent away from home. Okay. When for the rest of my siblings it came along, and it was easier, but it was never easy for any of us. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, when it was just the three of us boys and my third brother, Dan, and so I was about 10 and my brother, Dan, no, he would have been 7. So 4 years, I would have been about 11, but he got homesick, and we would try to spend time together. And all of a sudden he got homesick and start crying. And pretty soon my other brother, Tim, was crying. And pretty soon all three of us were crying, so there were those times.
Yes. Okay.
On the other hand, boarding school, we had people who we interacted with. Mm-hmm. We tried to, stay current, mm-hmm. although the music and other fads took about 2 years to get from the United States to where we were. So we were always way behind. I mean, when the Beatles were popular here, we got it 2 years later, So we were listening to great new music, we thought, but it was 2 years behind. And then when I came to, it was very different. When I came to seventh grade, because I had, my first second through sixth grade down in Colombia or Venezuela at boarding school. When I came back in seventh grade, it was complete culture shock.
Okay.
It was wild. It was actually in 1968, we were... Martin Luther King was assassinated, during that year. And so who was the other? There was another assassination. But we were, the race stuff and all of this was so new. And it was just a real culture shock. And, of course, then I would tell people I was growing up in South America, and so they would say, well, what do you do? Ride to horseback, and the Indians chase you and stuff.
Okay,
and there was no real concept of what life was like in other countries as well. Hmm. So yes, I went to boarding school second grade through 12th grade. Okay. As I mentioned, in 1973, I graduated from high school. Then while we were in Colombia, let me just say a little bit about my childhood. We moved around a lot. We ended up living in about 6 or 7 different towns and places where my dad would go. And sometimes we moved because the job was, he had done something and finished. Other times we moved because it was too dangerous for us to be there after a while. And so those were the, but those were the times that they were back in the early 60s. And my parents were the first missionaries to get into Colombia in 40 years, in 1957, because they had had, they had missionaries and American missionaries, but new ones hadn't come in because there was a real time of unrest in Colombia at that time. Okay. So that was a hard time for, there were different times where it was hard for our family, and so we would move occasionally.
Were you aware of that danger, or did your parents kind of try to shield you from it?
I was at boarding school a good bit of the time, right. But I would hear about it. Okay. And they did try to shield us from it. But, I mean, there was one time where my father was almost killed, and my brother and my mother were there. And so we knew about it. Okay. But we moved out of that town and less 2 months later.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, as fast as we could get out.
Absolutely. Okay, wow. I guess, like...
On the other hand, I love to travel with my father and go on those trips. I mean, I had my first trip with my dad when I was 5 years old, and he put me on top of a mule, and we rode up into the mountains. You know, my dad played an accordion, mm-hmm. and so we would go up into the mountains, and he would play his accordion. I mean, people would come from all over because I mean, here's this music, you know, and so I had my first trip with him at age 5. My brothers and I learned to swim because my dad also would travel on a river, but he wouldn't take us if we didn't know how to swim, because if something happened, we needed to be able to swim. And I mean, we were traveling in a crocodile-infested, piranha-infested rivers. And we would throw a fishing line over the side, you know, and pull out a piranha, and then you'd kill it real quick before it jumped up. One of our friends who took us on that trip, he was missing the digit of his right index finger, because when he was a kid fishing, he hadn't killed the piranha fast enough, and when he was reaching down to get some bait, it jumped up and took off part of his finger. So, you know, these are the kind of adventures. That's why I wouldn't trade my life growing up for anything. There were times that it was hard, but there were times like that. I mean, my brothers and I, when we were in high school, and I returned from college 2 years for the summer, we would go hiking to places where they had never seen people with blonde hair and blue eyes. You know, I mean, we would just hike through some of the jungles or hike into different places. And it was great. I mean, it was something that you don't often have that opportunity. And so in the 60s and 70s, when we were growing up there in Colombia, it was a great time. And we loved it. We went to, as I said, we went to boarding school. And there you had your set of friends. You knew people. And... you could then transfer from an educational, high school to a college here in the U.S.
Okay. Were most of your friends at the boarding school, I mean, international as well, I assume, if it was an English
speaking? This was an English speaking, so actually it was run by the mission organization that my parents belonged to. They started it for, so we had kids who would come from Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, the ABC Islands, Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao, Trinidad, Tobago. So they would all come to that boarding school.
Wow. What was the name of the boarding school?
Christensen Academy.
Okay, gotcha.
It went out of existence. Let's see. They actually closed. I mean, you know that Venezuela and Colombia, I mean, Venezuela now is just, you can't get in, and it's very, you know, the economy and all kinds of things are in disarray. Back then, Venezuela actually was doing better than Colombia. Okay. It was more the oil company and things had made Venezuela much more prosperous. Mm. And so it was actually on a much better economic level. And we were able to bring all these people in. The mission built a school. We had dorms, you know, and we would bring all these people in. And it was much, in many cases, much safer than where, you know, my parents or other parents of kids might be, you know, in those areas and or in different countries.
Okay. Right. What did you enjoy studying the most at school, and how did that kind of inform like going into college then?
Well, I mean, interestingly, you're a history. I love history. I also love literature. I love to read, but history and literature were my two favorite subjects. And so I enjoy geography as well. I mean, because of growing up in two different countries, it's actually knowing about South America. I mean, I just loved the various aspects of knowing about our countries, and then of course you come to the United States and people are like, oh, South America, oh, Columbia, wait, I thought Columbia was Columbia University, you know. and so no, it's a country in South America. It's right on the top part of the South America. Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, you get most of your coffee. Remember Juan Valdez, you know, that commercial you'd see on television about Juan Valdez, a coffee from Colombia? That's what they're talking about. But you usually had to make that, that connection for people.
Exactly, okay. And then so, yeah, I guess maybe easing more than a little bit into college, you returned to the United States for college?
Yes, I did. My parents wanted... This is another thing that I honored my parents. They wanted us to go into the ministry. And so I went to a Bible college and got an undergraduate degree in theology.
Okay.
Then I got a master's degree in counseling. I've always been into helping and working. I worked as a therapist for a number of years, but that's partly why I was in, I worked for the American Cancer Society before I came to, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And Clearway, Minnesota was about helping people quit smoking. Mm-hmm. And that was about changing behavior. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of my training and background was helping people in behavioral change or in making things, different in your life as a therapist. So these were all parts of the things. But it also was good public health, you know. I mean, it... helping reduce population smoking the way we did changed our state for the better and, changes countries and other places for the better as well.
What kind of culture shock did you experience going from boarding school into American college?
Oh, the culture shock was in many different levels. I mean, people talk about shows that I only saw on like Nickelodeon reruns, like, you know, Leave It to Beaver. Of course, that's way before your time.
Yeah.
But, a lot of the shows that were on in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. I don't have that cultural context.
Okay.
And so the only reason, when my son was growing up, my daughters were growing up, here in the U.S., we would have Nickelodeon or some of those other channels where they would do all these reruns from the 60s. That's the only reason. The Brady Bunch or, people...
Yeah.
I only know those because I then saw them on reruns when my kids were growing up. But I did not have those cultural contexts. So everything from different cultural aspects mm-hmm. that were common to an everyday teenager... When I got here for college, I mean, I had no idea what those were. Same thing, I was from South America, where we're in the tropics, but I went to my first school was upstate New York, where it got to 40 below zero. I had never experienced that kind of cold before. I hadn't experienced that much snow ever in my life. So that was a shock in and of itself. but also just a lot of the things that people do that you just don't think about it here because you grow up with it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you grow up in another country and it's not part of your culture or part of your upbringing, for instance, you know, getting a driver's license and being able to go out and you know, once you own a car. I mean, I didn't own my first car till I was second or third year in college. So those are the kinds of different things that I didn't experience in the same way that someone who going here to high school and, you know, they get a driver's license, they drive their parents' car, and then they maybe get their own car, and then they start going out on dates, you know, and stuff like that. No, that wasn't part of it.
My gosh. And sorry, Vista, so you're going to school in upstate New York, you said?
Yes, right.
Okay, what was the name of the school?
It was a Bible Institute.
Okay. And then your parents are still living in South America at this time, along with
your siblings? They stayed there till 19... I'm sorry, I made a mistake earlier.
Okay.
My father started teaching at the Bible Institute in 1968.
Gotcha.
When we went back from when I was in seventh grade. But then because of the drug cartels, mm-hmm, and stuff in the 80s, my parents left right around 1985 because it was too dangerous, okay, to be in Colombia anymore as an American. Not because of what they were doing as missionaries, but because of the drug cartels, the Escobar and many of them, they would just kidnap Americans, and whether they were missionaries or diplomats or Peace Corps or whomever, if they were American citizens, they would kidnap them to try to keep, you know, or do an exchange.
Okay.
And a number of people that my parents knew were kidnapped. A couple of them were killed. Others of them were released and said, get out of the country. And my parents just said, you know, it's time for us to step away, you know, from this. And so they left Colombia around 1985.
Okay. And so I remember, where did they go after that?
They came here to the United States.
They did? Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I was working at a Bible college at the time. My father taught there for a while. It's called Citadel Bible College.
Okay.
My father worked there for a while, and then he went back, and because he had done these low literacy courses in Spanish,
mm-hmm,
another mission organization asked him to come and join, and then he started going all over the world with my mom. My dad had a retinal detachment,
mm-hmm,
and so he had trouble seeing. He was going blind, and so my mom would travel with him, but my dad would take these low literacy courses. He would do them in Spanish, like in Spain, in other countries in South America. But if he would go to a country where, like Germany, mm-hmm, and he didn't speak German, he would send the material over and missionaries over there would translate it, and then he would go and teach, and he'd use a translator to teach.
Oh, wow.
So my parents actually traveled to all 6 continents. The only one they didn't make it to is Antarctica.
Shoot.
And my dad said, well, we're not going to preach to the penguins, so.
Fair enough.
But they got, yes, they traveled to Asia, different parts in Asia, to Africa, a number of different countries in Africa, quite a few different countries in Europe, obviously in South America because they spoke Spanish. So yes, they had been all over the world.
That's remarkable.
Even went to Fiji, not because they loved the South Pacific, but because he actually went there and taught.
And did you remain close with your family, kind of?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. My father passed away in 2015. He had Parkinson's, and my sister lives in Kansas City, and my parents were, the headquarters for their mission was out near Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up, after my dad started, was diagnosed with Parkinson's, we moved them to Kansas City to be near my sister. And it was only a 7-8 hour drive from here. And so many times I would go down. Yes, my dad passed away in 2015 from Parkinson's, and then my mom passed away in 2017. But we were very close, yeah. I have a brother who is in South America, has been a missionary there for years, in Argentina and Uruguay. I have another brother who was a missionary both in Germany and in South Africa for a number of years. My sister and her husband are in ministry. They have a pastor of a church in Kansas City, and then my youngest brother is a pastor of a church in Long Island. So
you're all over.
Well, I'm the one. I'm sort of the black sheep of the family. I'm the one who's not in the ministry. Okay. So.
Yeah, maybe that's a good transition to kind of talk about a little bit. You started speaking about your career path, but anything else that you would like to add to that, how you essentially came to Clearway?
Well, one of the things, smoking was very prevalent in Latin America.
Okay.
There weren't any, smoking campaigns. Plus, there weren't any laws about selling cigarettes to kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so kids would start smoking, I mean, literally, age 7, 8, 9, 10, if the parents didn't care, they'd be smoking. And in Latin America, the cheapest cigarettes don't have filters, and it's horrible. I think 7th or 8th grade, we went hiking one time. We were hiking, and this old man we found on our hike, he gave us a couple of cigarettes that we thought were going to be cool. They were non-filtered cigarettes. And so we all lit up, thought we were going to be cool. And so, you take this big drag on a cigarette. And literally, I mean, some of the hot, ash is going in your mouth. It's this unfiltered smoke going in your... I mean, literally, I almost threw up. Coughed and spit, and all of us, we thought we were, there were about five or six of us, we all thought we were going to be cool, and pretty much that did it for me. I never wanted to try it again.
Really?
It made me so sick. Now, of course, later you learn about, cool and menthol and all this that helps mask that and the fact that filters do, but to me it was like, why? There's nothing there for it. So, It pretty much cured me of wanting to smoke, but in Colombia, Venezuela, many people die of smoking related illnesses because it is and back then I know that they now World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization and a number of countries have passed laws about selling and advertising and things like that. But back in the 60s and early 70s, it was easy access.
Okay.
There weren't any smoking campaigns going on, non-smoking, anti-smoking campaigns when I was growing up. I became aware of those as we started, working with the American Cancer Society.
Mm-hmm.
I started with the American Cancer Society, so a little bit more about my career.
Mm-hmm.
I started with the American Cancer Society in 1996. I had been working in Arizona with Maricopa County Public Health and doing a number of public health programs there. But then in 1996, I began with the American Cancer Society. And part of their programs, along with doing, breast cancer awareness and screening for women, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer. One of the biggest things they do is, took what they call tobacco control, and it's anti-tobacco or helping people quit smoking as well. So these are the programs to, help people quit, keep kids from starting. And so that's when I really became familiar with that kind of work. My wife, Ruth, was working with the Cancer Society as well.
Oh, okay.
And that's how we met. We were working together as co-workers. She was doing public policy. She was a lobbyist for the Cancer Society, and she was traveling to a number of states all over the West and to Alaska, but she also was helping work in Arizona. And so we worked to pass a few smoke-free laws in Arizona, and that's how we met. And she is from Minnesota.
Ah.
So in 1998, when they had the tobacco settlement here in Minnesota, they had a special conference here to celebrate that. And my wife came back, and she knew many of the people who had been involved. She knew Doug Blonkey and a few of the other people that had been involved with the tobacco trial. And so that's when I got to hear about, you know, some of what was going on with the 1998, you know, tobacco trial and settlement.
Okay. Were you tracking the trial at all as it was happening? Or were you...
No.
Okay.
Did not. I found out a lot about it later because Dr. Richard Hurt, who was one of their key witnesses, was the chair of our board, you know, for 4 years. So,
okay.
And was my supervisor when I, you know, first came here. So I learned all about it. But I was working at the Cancer Society, and Clearway started in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And Attorney General Skip Humphrey set us in the settlement, set aside $202 million for 25 years and to have an independent nonprofit organization that would work on reducing the harm of tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
That started, they had their first board meeting in September of 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. C. Everett Koop and Dr. David Kessler were actually members of that board and then became honorary members of the board.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Richard Hurt was chair of the board. And they started to begin programs. They started to hire staff, you know, and started to work on programs. So that's how Clearway started. Their first executive director was there only for a couple of months. It didn't work out. I don't know the details of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in May of 2000, because my wife was from Minnesota, somebody in Minnesota sent her a job announcement for the executive director. And Clearway's name before we changed it was known as Minnesota Partnership for Action Against Tobacco. So some people called us MPAT, M-P-A-A-T.
Mm-hmm.
Others called us the anti-tobacco people
mm-hmm.
because we were, you know, the name said Action Against Tobacco.
Okay.
So, but that's what the name was.
Okay.
And they advertised for an executive director. And my wife saw the announcement. She said, oh, this looks like something for you to check into. I said, what? And so, all right. You know, I'd never been to Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
But I submitted my resume. We were actually, because she's from Minnesota, her parents have a cabin on a lake up, you know, up near on Breezy Point, on a Pelican Lake, or Breezy, near Breezy Point.
Yeah.
We were up there when I got a call saying that the search committee of the board would like to do an interview. Now, we were up there on vacation, so
yeah.
I didn't have, I was, you know, in summer stuff, and I had not planned. So we actually went on the way to the interview. We stopped in St. Cloud at a Dayton's, and I bought a whole outfit for the interview. And so that was my interview outfit that I bought, and I came and met with the you know, the first group, you know, of the search firm and a small, a couple of members of the board, you know, that first interview. And they were interested enough that then in August of that same year, then I was flown up to meet with the full board search committee.
Okay.
And I was hired, they offered me the job and I accepted in September of 2000. So I resigned from my position at the Cancer Society. My wife and I, and my wife did not want to do winters in Minnesota because she had grown up in Minnesota.
She knew what it was like.
But my wife and I moved back to Minnesota, and I started November 1st of 2000.
Oh, wow. Okay. Did you have, do you have kids?
I had two daughters who, you know, by an earlier marriage, they're now in their 40s, but they were just finishing college at that time.
Okay.
And then Ruth and I have Cooper, who's now 21.
Oh, okay, okay. And so he was not born yet?
No.
Okay, gotcha.
Ruth and I only have one child, and that's Coop. Yep. So
gotcha.
We got married, came up here, and then Ruth got pregnant, you know, and he was born in 2002. So
okay.
2 years after we got here, he was born.
Very cool. Okay. Perfect.
Can we take a break? I could use a little bit of water.
Please, let me just pause it. All right, are you ready to start again?
Perfect. Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, all set.
Do you want to start with the question?
Yes, please.
Okay.
All right, so can you please briefly explain how Clearway came to be and the nature of its mission?
Sure.
I just already talked a little bit about that. Maybe mission more.
Right. Well, so like I said, and I won't try to repeat as much, but Attorney Skip Humphrey set aside the money.
Yes.
And the mission of Clearway was to reduce the harm that tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. Now this is what's real critical that a lot of people don't understand, and I'll reference it later on in some of the uniqueness and some of the challenges, but we were a life-limited organization.
Yes.
We were given 25 years to do this work, and after 25 years, basically, we are to go out of existence. And so they started in 1998, as I mentioned. They had their first board meeting. They hired an ED. Then I came on in 2000. When I arrived in 2000, they had basically three programs that they were starting to work on. These are standard anti-tobacco or tobacco reduction, what we call tobacco control. These are terms that are used by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
Okay.
They have best practices for how to help states across the country. They have these best practices on what you do to help reduce the harm of tobacco and help people quit smoking or to prevent from smoking. Some of those things are you have, you know, quit programs. Okay. And so another is you have advertising campaigns.
Okay.
Another is you, you do public policy. And then two that are part of what they recommend, but not a lot of organizations either can afford to do them, or is working specifically with what we call priority populations. These are populations, communities of color mainly, who have higher morbidity and mortality rates due to tobacco use. Many times it's the disparity issues that we have, you know, in health-related disparities. And the tobacco industry specifically targets minority and disparate communities with, I mean, this is why menthol was developed. It's called, you know, it was developed for as a African-American, a black cigarette, you know, for African-Americans. And it was marketed and targeted it that way. There were other advertising and campaigns targeted at Hispanic, Latino, Southeast Asian. So what we began to do, so when I came in 2000, they had just started their cessation program.
Okay.
They had put out an RFP and were starting to develop a helpline. One of the standard things about helping people quit is having a quit line where people can call, make it easier for them instead of having to just go into, you know, a place to see a doctor or whatever.
Makes sense.
Secondly, they had started an ad campaign to start advertising. And then they had just begun to put out an RFP, request for proposal, for researchers to do research here in Minnesota around tobacco control. So when I arrived, the budget was around $8 to $10 million that year. They had about 8 staff. We then began to expand our programs. We started ramping up not only doing the Quitline, but we also then started developing places where they could get help, both at clinics and facilities and things like that. So we started to expand the programs. We started to look at doing public policy.
Okay.
As we were starting to do that, we got a new attorney general. This is one of the challenges that we faced. The new attorney general did not feel like we were doing the right thing with the money. Felt like we should only be doing stop smoking programs. We should not be doing policy. We should not be doing research, things like that. And so that attorney general tried to take the dollars away from us. We were tied up for about 2 years in litigation. Then finally, because, and here's one of the things that's different, because we were under the jurisdiction of the court, we then were able to have a trial and the judge could determine whether or not it was the right use for the funds. But in other states across the country where tobacco settlement dollars were put out, they were put under either the legislature or the executive branch. And most of those states, when they hit hard times, lost all or most of their money. And the only reason why we were able to actually spend out and do the 23 years that we did is because we were under the jurisdiction of the court.
And that was because that's how they decided.
That's how, that is exactly how Attorney General Skip Humphrey set it up. Under, it was a court settlement and it was under the jurisdiction of the court and the court had supervision over that organization. That is the most unique. There is only one other state that was set up similarly, and that's Oklahoma, but it was done by a resolution of the people. And so the people voted to do that and have their money go. And so then the legislature couldn't override that. So there are only about, I think that's the only other state that had a similar type situation, not exactly like ours, not under the court, where the legislature or the executive branch, being the governor, couldn't just take the money away.
And Skip knew what he was doing when he...
That, the Skip and his team had done some of the research on that and realized that that was... And Dr. C. Everett Koop and Dr. David Kessler wrote a white paper about that as well. And they recommended that it be done that way. And Attorney General Humphreys followed that. And that's why we... I mean, that was the most unique thing about Clearway that kept us going and allowed us to spend the money that we had. Another aspect that's, you know, unique is we then became a comprehensive, you know, organization. There were certain things, if you, I don't know if you've looked into this, but people who were familiar, the health department received part of the settlement dollars. And Jan Malcolm was set up as the director of under Governor Ventura. She was the commissioner of health. And she started a program called Target Market. In the 5 years that they were going, they saw teen smoking reduce phenomenally. And it was very successful. And then they had a downturn, and Governor Pawlenty, you know, needed the money, and so he took all the money that was actually set aside, and it was over $500 million. $500 million was set aside in a specific fund, and the health department was only using the interest, and they had a $25 million a year budget those first 5 years, around that much, and. Governor Pawlenty took that money and used it to, you know, take care of the deficit, and it completely wiped out all the programs that they had going. So that was Clearway was able to be, or MPAT at that time, but then Clearway was able to not have that money taken because we were under the court.
Exactly.
If we'd have been under the legislature, he'd have taken our money as well.
Okay.
So what we did then is we started working, and we were, because the health department got money to work with youth, mm-hmm. we were basically designated to work with adults.
Okay.
So that's why we talk about our successes as being with adults. However, many of our programs did then work with youth, and we did allow youth to call our helpline and access our services, especially after the health department lost their money.
Okay.
But our target and what we were designated to do was work with adults.
Okay.
So that's why our Quit Smoking, our Quit Plan Services program,
mm-hmm.
we did basically five programs then. Quit Plan Services, which helped people quit smoking. We had both a quit line, and we had a lot of other different services that were available to people.
Gotcha.
All right. They also could get nicotine replacement therapy, patches or gum. All this was free of charge to anybody who did not have health insurance, or if their health insurance didn't cover it. Free of charge.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
Secondly, we started putting money into research and funding research programs to help people understand and help. We gave grants to University of Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, and others to do research around tobacco prevention and tobacco reducing tobacco's harm.
Gotcha.
We did advertising and marketing campaigns. We did public policy. One of the things that the judge approved
mm-hmm.
when we had gone to trial is the attorney general had challenged that we could not lobby, but the judge approved and said that we could use our money for lobbying, and so we were actually able to lobby, and we were also able to give grants to allow other organizations to actually lobby. So we regularly hired and had some of our staff as lobbyists on the Capitol, at the Capitol, changing public policy.
Wow, okay.
And then finally, we had programs because a lot of the work around, we call them communities of color or priority populations.
Mm-hmm.
And who we worked with here in Minnesota was African American, Hispanic, Latino, Southeast Asian, which included Vietnamese, Hmong, Laotian, American Indian, and then LGBTQ.
Okay.
We had those populations where their rates of use and their morbidity and mortality rates were higher many times than the white population. And the industry would specifically target those populations.
Okay.
And so that's why we began programs to specifically build capacity, because many of them didn't have individuals or people in their communities or community organizations who worked in tobacco control or public health. And so okay. we start building capacity.
Okay. Can you explain a little bit more like what that looks like, I guess?
Sure.
Like, yeah.
So what we did, there are two things we specifically did. One is we developed a fellowship program.
Okay.
And over the course of, I think it was three different times, we had a fellowship where we would take in five or six individuals from each of these communities. Mm-hmm. They would go through a two-year program. They would learn about tobacco control. They would learn about lobbying. We would do these courses, and we contracted with an organization out of California who had been doing capacity building among communities of color, and we would help them learn about how to take some of these things and go back into their communities. And so we would fund them, and because many of them were working, we would give them a stipend if they had to miss work.
Sure.
And we also then would, once they finished, we would have about five or six from each mm-hmm. Of these five communities. Mm-hmm. And then we would give them some money for them to do a project at the end of each of the fellowships.
Wow.
And this way they had to write a grant for that project. Yeah. It wasn't just automatic. So we were trying to, through the process, we were trying to teach them about how to do grant writing, how to do public policy. We would take them. They would go to the Capitol. They would learn how to do this. When Governor Dayton mm-hmm. said he would not raise the tobacco tax because he felt that it was not fair to people of color, we had these individuals come together and both write him a letter and send him communication, and that this was something that they were in favor of. And as a result of him hearing from some of them,
yeah.
and of course we then, with our lobbyists and others, made sure that, you know, legislators and others, then he was willing to do that. And so that was some of the difference that they were able to make. And many of them talked about that, how that was a highlight for them to be able to have the governor hear their voice, hear that they did want to see a tobacco tax happen, because the scourge of tobacco and the addiction that tobacco was in their community, they wanted to see that change. And because there were programs like Quit Plant Services to help their community quit free of charge, then they didn't feel like it was that much of a hardship. And so they communicated that, and it was a great opportunity. So those are some of the things that they learned. And then as a result, we saw many of them start to change their jobs. Some of them got into public health. Some of them actually got into public policy work. And it was just a fascinating way to see people grow and develop. And then many of them would go back into their communities to work as well.
Absolutely. Wow. Oh, that's remarkable. That's so cool. Did I cut you off earlier when you
nope.
were talking? Okay, perfect.
Okay.
That's good. Great. Then, yeah. So I think we kind of covered the first one or two, three questions, mm-hmm. I'd say. Do you want to go maybe a little bit into challenges that
sure.
Slavery has faced? Besides, obviously, the Attorney General.
Sure. Well, and that was one of them.
Yes.
But we've already covered that.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of what was always a challenge, there are always more needs and desires for and opportunities to fund than we had money.
Okay.
We decided that we were going to run as long as we could.
Okay.
Our budgets increased. I remember I said earlier that it started about $10,000. We actually increased our budgets and were averaging about $14 to $18 million a year through 2018, and then we started winding down. But at the height of our funding, we were doing around $15 to $18 million a year.
Okay.
And we, I think part of the challenge is we had to prioritize, because we wanted to see the rates change among adults.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to help people quit. We knew we had to provide free smoking cessation through our Quit Plant Service for anybody who wanted. We wanted to see some research being done to help push and learn about some of these things.
Yeah.
We wanted to see policies change.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what is a challenge is prioritizing and budgeting.
Okay.
That is not easy. And people think, oh, it's really easy. You had all this money. Well, the problem is you just don't give it all away at once.
Exactly.
Plus, we had invested a lot of it, okay? So we received $202 million. We ended up spending over $280 million. That was due in part, and that was another one of the challenges, mm-hmm. is managing investments of a life-limited organization.
Okay.
And so you can't just invest. Many universities and others, they just invest their money and spend an endowment.
Right.
But what we were doing is we were having to spend principal and interest and try to gauge that so that we ran out of money right as we were, you know, what we called it is landing the plane, you know, with just enough gas to get to the runway and not run out too soon.
Exactly.
We were scheduled to go to 2023.
Right.
We actually ended in December of 2021 because we wanted to do and spend enough money when we had the staff, when we had the resources, and so we did spend at a little higher rate, which ended up cutting off a year and a half of the organization.
Okay.
Had it, I mean, it just said, if we were in existence in of July 1st of 2023, we had to turn any of that money back over to the state.
Yeah.
So we could have gone out any time.
Okay.
But what we did is we went out of existence and I felt like we did pretty good, because in December of 2021, mm-hmm. We turned over less than $30,000 to the state. We spent that much.
Insane.
And just handing them back about a little over, right around
$30,000. Oh my gosh.
So that was another challenge, mm-hmm. is how to manage those investments when you're a life-limited organization. Another was, and this is what I think was one of the hardest and most difficult, is that you have to shut down the organization.
Mm.
You have to eventually then shut down programs. You have to let staff go. And you actually have to shut down the organization.
Okay.
And so I think those were some of the challenges. I'll talk a little bit more about that. Some of the unique experiences as a CEO was that shutting down of the organization.
Exactly.
Most CEOs, when they come in, and I ended up staying in, for 21 of the 23 years, that we were in existence, most don't shut down their organization willfully, and people, and that was the, we had term limits for board members. And so they could only be on the board for 6 years. So every time we got new board members, they're like, what? You're going out of existence? Why? What? You're doing such good work. It's because we have to. No, you can't do that, and it was always a challenge educating our board about a life-limited organization and the fact that we were have to go out of existence.
Okay.
And so those were, and you could imagine somebody who, you've got this successful ad campaign, $4 or $5 million ad campaign, ads on TV, people are calling up and using the quit line and quitting smoking, we're doing research, and people are saying, we're doing good work. Why are we shutting down?
Yeah.
And it's because we have to. Because if we don't spend this money and do it well and do it right, then what's going to happen is at the end of this time, we're going to have this money left and we're going to have to give it back to the state.
Exactly.
Or you're not spending enough money to really have an impact.
Okay.
And that's why we landed on this budget of about $15 to $18 million, which gave us synergy with all the programs,
okay.
gave us staff that we needed to have to get the accomplishments that we knew would reduce the harm.
Okay. Excuse my layperson question, but...
No, that's all right.
Why couldn't Clearway have just morphed into something else? Like, I know you need a budget, obviously, to operate, but it seems like you were doing so much good work that's
a really good question.
Okay.
And this is why some people would ask, why don't you do fundraising?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had organizations like the American Cancer Society, the American Lung Association,
okay.
American Heart Association. They all do fundraising around tobacco control. They didn't want an organization that had $200 million doing fundraising and taking the money away from them.
Fair enough.
Okay. Secondly, we had individuals, and this is one of the things that the Attorney General said, once the money is spent,
mm-hmm.
This needs to go out of existence. There is no capacity to extend it beyond. If you do, we're going to take whatever money you have at that 2023 date. So if we would have tried to get other money,
mm-hmm.
and not spend it before we went out of existence, it was still going to have to go back to the state, because that's how we were started.
Okay.
And so in the state in the settlement agreement and the way we were designed, mm-hmm. if we'd have tried to push the envelope, the court would have sided then with whomever, because we were then going beyond what the court approved and how we were founded. A lot of people ask, well, why don't you just change your name and But then we couldn't have kept the funds.
Exactly.
You see?
Exactly.
Why don't you try to give the money? And that's the, again, the, all of that was covered when we went to trial. It's mm-hmm. like, if you try to bypass the 23, you know, the 25-year period, mm-hmm. we'll know that. And then that's when we'll step in with the court.
Okay.
So, no, it's a great question. Believe me, many people ask that question. Board members ask that question. So it was a great question. And it seems like an obvious question, too. It's like, why didn't you do that? And it's because they had all figured it all out. And they were, I mean, the tobacco industry did not want us around. Not only that, and this is part of what, I mean, the last person, one of the last people with me, she and I were deposed by Juul for the lawsuit for the state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, these are all the things that were going on because we had been so effective. They did not want us, Altria, they did not want us around. So the sooner we got out of and had to finish, the better.
That makes sense. Could you talk a little bit maybe about the transition, like as Clearway was closing, how did you, like what did you tell the people that were using Clearway's services? Did you just point them in a different direction? Was there any?
This was a, and great question. Mm-hmm. We studied, I studied, and then we as a staff gathered information from life-limited organizations that went out of existence, and we learned from them.
Okay.
There are a number. There was one called the Belden Fund that was had money for 10 years, and then they went out of existence. And then Atlantic Philanthropies mm-hmm. Was another organization in New York, and they had $6 billion in assets. They worked in seven different countries, but they went out of existence. 80% of their staff went out of existence in 2016. Just before they went out of existence, we found out, and we went to New York and met with their chief HR officer and their executive team.
Okay.
And we learned a lot. And what we learned from them, they had developed a way to shut down the organization where they would have staff and programs shut down in sort of tranches.
Oh, okay.
And so what they did is they wouldn't just have everybody go at once. We learned from them, and we had basically then four periods where people started to leave. The first one started in 2018 and ended it when we finished in 2021. There were just two of us on staff. But so what we would do, and we clearly laid this out. We laid it out for the board. We laid it out for the staff. And then one of the things that we learned from Atlantic Philanthropies is that you start to let everybody know when their time is. And if they want to leave earlier, what we also did is we tried to incentivize with severance packages.
Sure.
If you stayed until your date, you got a severance package.
Okay.
If you left before, you didn't.
Okay.
And so we tried to incentivize. We had when we started that, we had 28 staff. We had six who ended up leaving on their own time.
Yeah.
The others all stayed to their dates. And so we had four different times where people would leave, started in 2018, okay. and we shut down the programs, and we let the staff go with those programs. So that was the other key.
Okay.
So it was programs and staff who were running them. Programs and staff who were running them. So that's how we were able to make those decisions about staff and programming.
Okay.
So, and that was, I think, one of the hardest. Because, you know, people stayed and they were committed. And then, you know, we gave them, if they stayed, like we said, we gave them a severance. We also worked with a outplacement company to help them find jobs.
Okay.
But it was very hard because in some cases, I had worked with some of these individuals for 10, 15. I worked with one individual for over 20 years. And so it was hard because you become like a family almost.
Absolutely.
And these are the individuals who are leaving. And of course, you're close to them and you want to see them succeed. You want to make sure they get a good job wherever they're going. So I think that was the hardest part. We had to reduce our board. Mm. We had to reduce our staff. And you talked about the programs, and this was one of the hardest because we would tell people, we would tell grantees, your grants and contracts are going to end at this time.
Wow. Yeah.
And there won't be any more. And then they would keep coming back and saying, but, you know, and we would try to help them find other funding. But in some cases, there wasn't other funding. And so, you know, those were the hard parts of this whole process is that we saw organizations and funding that we had done, some of the programs were completely shut down and couldn't continue. But we did, you know, and we tried to do capacity building among those. And some of the ways we do that is we give grants. I mean, for instance, with American Indian communities, we gave some of those communities and other places grants for over 10 years. But the last couple of years, then what we tried to do is incentivize them. We would give them a little less and try to have them start to find other sources of income or funding while we were slowly dropping the amount we were doing.
Okay.
And that's what we were trying to do in capacity building.
I see. How did you decide which programs and like departments, I guess, to shut down first? Like, what was the...
I mean, that was, I think, the hardest.
Yeah.
Again, one of the things we always wanted to do is our public policy had some of the broadest impacts.
Makes
because
sense.
You're doing population-based.
Yeah.
So that was one of the ones we waited to shut down. We began shutting down some of our capacity-building programs.
Mm-hmm.
We start spending less on our marketing and advertising.
Okay.
We cut down our budgets on that. And we stopped funding research projects. We, about, I think 2018 was the last research RFP that went out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we gave grants for 3 years.
Okay.
Now, so some of them went almost till 2021.
Sure.
Once they were awarded, but we didn't award any more after that.
Okay.
So that's how we, you know, we did, okay, here's where we're going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And then we developed strategic plans backward.
Okay.
Around these various programs.
Okay. Sounds. Yeah, that sounds.
It wasn't easy. I mean, that's unique.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's hard. And you say, okay, if we're going to end the grant programs in research, you know, and we have to shut down and everybody has to be done and have their final reports to us in 2021, and we're giving out 3-year grants, here's where we have to, this is the last place we have to do it. We can do it.
Exactly. Okay.
And then and I had one of the grants that ran over, you know, and didn't spend down all the money because of COVID.
Oh,
and so
no.
What we did is we ended up giving the money to them through the health department.
Okay.
But because they didn't draw down because of the, you know, COVID limited their ability to do some of that work. So, I mean, these are all the challenges that were happening, and COVID made it even more difficult.
Oh my gosh. Any other COVID-related
things? Well, we had to go completely... So, in 2020,
yeah,
we were going to close our offices in June of 2021.
Right, okay.
But we went remote in 2020.
Gotcha.
And we never went back to the office. But I had to still pay rent on an office we weren't using until June of 2021.
Wow.
Because we had signed a lease.
Okay.
So that was really frustrating.
Sounds like it, yeah.
So, you know, I mean, those are the things that people never think about, you know, but you've signed a lease, they're not going to let you out, but you can't be in there. And by the time people were starting to go back, it was late 2021 and we were ready to close the office anyway.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, there you have it.
Did smoking rates rise at all during COVID? Did they decrease because of the...
No. Okay. I mean, I think what we saw among vaping, I mean, there were more people who anecdotally were doing it.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
People would talk about it more, but we didn't see a change in the rates as such. You have to see a huge... you know, a huge change to see the kind of rate change that happened over the...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Last day of Clearway.
Last day. December 31, 2021.
Wow.
There were just two staff left, Director of Finance and me. And we were already working remotely. We had been working, we worked for over 2 years on dissolution. Because what we did is we first reduced the size of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, you know, we're letting staff go already. And then I got, we hired a nonprofit attorney who developed dissolution papers.
Okay.
We filed those dissolution papers with the court. We had a hearing during COVID, so it was on Zoom. We met with the judge and our attorneys, and we presented our dissolution documents to the judge at Ramsey County. You know, we sent it all in, our dissolution plan, our documents. We had then a video conference with him over Zoom. He asked a few questions. He approved our dissolution, and then we then put that into operation, with it finalizing then on December 31. We got his approval of that in the summer of 2021.
Oh, okay.
So we got approval of it in June. We wanted to make sure everything was up front, you know, make sure he had the opportunity, because we were then going to go actually in complete shutdown mode. But we wanted the court to approve it. And then so the last day, we already had all the, we had a plan already. All the papers were signed. Mm-hmm. The attorney had gone and to the Minnesota Department of State, filed our dissolution papers.
Yeah.
You know, we had a final meeting. We had three board members that we reported to that everything was done. We finished with them. And it was a bittersweet day.
Yeah. Yeah.
We were very proud of everything that we had accomplished and that we had been able to spend that amount of money and get the results that we did. But it also, it was, I mean, I'll tell you, it was the best job I ever had. And it was a dream job, and I loved it. It was a bittersweet day.
I can see that. I guess I'm envisioning you, like, just logging off or, like, shutting your computer for the last time, and that was just like, such a wild feeling. And you're retired now, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so nothing after Clearway then, you were...
I do a little bit of help with different, you know, occasionally, but no, I'm retired. I do volunteer work and so forth, but I'm not really looking to work right now, so it's fine. I'm enjoying some retirement, doing a little bit of traveling, so yes.
You ended on a high note.
Yeah.
Oh, that's perfect. Do you
want to
break?
Yes,
absolutely.
Let's grab another drink.
Water, for sure. Zoom. Okay, perfect. So we just finished kind of talking about Clearway as it was in action, moving on to maybe more of a post-Clearway kind of line of questioning. What would you consider to be Clearway's legacy or greatest accomplishment?
I think one of the greatest accomplishments is we spent over $280 million reducing the harm that tobacco causes the people of Minnesota. We did our first adult tobacco survey in 1999, and we saw the rates drop over the course of the years that we were working, so that in when we went out of existence, the adult smoking rate was at 13.8. So we saw a 37.5% drop in adult smoking rates in the state of Minnesota.
That's incredible.
We also, because of what Target Market did, mm-hmm. but also what I believe our advertising campaigns and the fact that we allowed youth to also access, we developed a youth protocol for our helpline. Mm-hmm. We also saw smoking rates among youth at their lowest at that time as well.
Wow.
So we were thrilled. Some of the accomplishments, I'm going to talk about the programs we had. We helped over 200,000 Minnesotans in their quitting smoking through our Quit Plan services. We helped them, you know, make quit attempts. We provided, as I said before, free nicotine replacement therapy, which included patches, gum, or lozenge, mm-hmm. You know, for anybody who wanted it. We helped over 200,000 Minnesotans. We funded Minnesota researchers with over $33 million in research grants. That was one of the things that was unique, is we only funded Minnesota researchers.
Okay.
So if you were a researcher on tobacco-related issues outside of Minnesota, we didn't fund any, but we funded places like Mayo Clinic researchers. We funded a number of researchers that were at the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We funded a number of researchers throughout the state, but it was only researchers in the state of Minnesota. So we provided over $33 million in research grants.
And was that Minnesota, was that, did the settlements tell you to only focus on Minnesota? Or is that
yes. Oh, okay. That's a really good point. I should have stated that up front. The money that we were using was to help Minnesotans.
Gotcha.
It was to reduce the harm for Minnesota. So what we would do, if there was not a service in Minnesota, mm-hmm. for instance, our quit line or our helpline mm-hmm. vendors, Mayo Clinic did it for a little while, and then they stopped. So we contracted with Mayo Clinic for a while, but when they stopped doing it, then we had to contract with a vendor outside of state. So the only time we would do contracts or grants outside of state is if there was no in-state provider.
Okay.
And so that's why we did, with our quit line, we used an out-of-state provider. The last one that did it, that we were using, actually, you know, was working through a branch of United Health Services. So again, it was, you know, it was part of Minnesota. But, you know, these are all the kinds of things that we had to take into consideration, because we were trying to do it in Minnesota for Minnesotans.
Exactly. Okay.
When we did our public policy work and advocacy and lobbying, mm-hmm. we saw major policies passed. In 2007, we saw the smoke-free, you know, bars, restaurants. We called it the Freedom to Breathe Act, but,
right.
you know, that was where all bars and restaurants went smoke-free. We've got a great story that my wife likes to tell people. We would travel with vacation with our son. Mm-hmm. He grew up here in Minnesota, and so he was about 8-10 years old, and we were in Florida at the time, I believe, or Texas, I forget. But anyway, a state that had not passed a statewide smoke-free law at the time.
Okay.
And so we were sitting at a table, and he pointed at something. He said, "What's that?" And my wife was just like, "He doesn't know what an ashtray is." He grew up in Minnesota,
oh,
where there were no ashtrays in restaurants or bars. So at the age of, I think it was around 10, He did not know what an ashtray was until we went to another, you know, another state that didn't have that law, and there was smoking in the restaurant. So it's a great way to talk about culture change, because here you have a group of kids like my son growing up where they're not exposed to it in restaurants. They don't even know what an ashtray is, and it's a great opportunity, and it just talks about the culture shift. We passed tobacco taxes. I've talked a little bit about that, which may, one of the best ways to help people quit is raise the price, especially among youth. We also passed first at local and then statewide what they called Tobacco 21, where you had, they, a person had to be 21 in order to buy tobacco products. We were able to get the legislature to fund the programs to the health department, send enough money when so that when we cut, we stopped quit plan services, the legislative session before, we were able to get funding to the health department, so they started their own what they call quit partner. So we got funding, we actually lobbied to fund the health department so they could keep doing the quit program services. And then we, the last thing we worked on were local policies. We never got a statewide policy to eliminate flavored sale in, you know, tobacco products, including menthol. So those are some of the successes we had in our public policy work. Marketing and advertising from about 2001 through 2018, we averaged $4 to $5 million ad campaigns every year, which primarily was running on television because smokers, their main medium was through television.
Okay.
That was one, we did, you know, market research, all kinds of stuff to find out. We had award-winning campaigns that were received awards. You know, all of our ads, once they were done, they were turned over to the Center for Disease Control. Okay. They have a media resource, and any state in the country and even other countries can use those. They just have to pay the royalties on them.
Wow.
So we've seen many states run ad campaigns, you know, that we actually had here.
Okay.
So just an aside, just a fun story, okay?
Sweet.
So California was one of the states that decided to use some of our campaigns, all right? One of the campaigns that we did is we had an ad called Ghost. And what it was a mom and a little baby. And you have this grandfather who is standing there, and he's like a ghost. And he's trying to get the little boy, and he's walking, and he ends up walking through the little boy. And the mom says, you know, I wish your grandpa were here to see you. Well, that ran in California. So Friends, the TV show Friends, Chandler was starting to smoke, and Monica, in the script, says, haven't you seen that ad about the grandpa? It's chilling. How can you smoke? So our ad actually became part of the culture of Friends. And was mentioned in their TV show because it ran in California.
So cool.
So it just, those are the kind of fun things that you never imagine are going to happen. But we actually, you know, we all, somebody taped it. And of course we all, you know, put it on DVD so
oh
we
God.
Could have,
it.
So we could have it. Yes. Hey, we were on Friends. And it was great. I mean, the ad campaigns made the difference in helping people go to our quit plan services. It made a difference in changing attitudes and behaviors. That's a big issue. And, you know, those are the things that the CDC has as part of their best practices.
Okay.
Another change that we saw was the fact that, you know, we funded communities of color, priority populations. We fund Minnesota tribes to help them with what we call restoring traditional tobacco. Traditional tobacco is not cigarettes. They use it in their traditions and rituals, but we helped fund the quit programs, but also helped them renew their traditional tobacco programs. And we funded 8 reservations for over 10 years to do those kind of programs. Okay. We worked with African-American communities to reduce the harm of menthol. Mm-hmm. You know, specifically provided the Leadership Institute that I talked about mm-hmm. for all of these communities. And we worked with Black, Indigenous, LGBT communities, provided them with tools, with opportunities and training to build their capacity, you know, so that they could then go back into their communities and talk about how the tobacco industry was targeting them or what kinds of programs and services best worked in their communities. Finally, what we did see is we did a study towards the end. We called it a legacy study. We wanted to see the impact that Clearway and its partners had over the course of our, you know, 23 years.
Yeah.
And so one of the studies that we funded showed that with Clearway and its partners, we estimate that we prevented over 4,500 cancers, tens of thousands of hospitalizations from smoking-related illnesses. We saved $1.5 billion in healthcare costs and productivity. We were also able to prevent over 4,000 smoking attributable deaths. So these are all the kinds of things that we really believe changed the health of Minnesota. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of.
That is amazing. The fact that you're able to quantify it like that. I mean,
yes.
There's something so special about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. No, oh, you must be. I mean, yes.
No, that was, I mean, that's why I say it was great to be able to have that study who helped us, some researchers helped us quantify that.
Wow. Right. So I guess, yes, that kind of leads into the next question then. What are you proudest of? It sounds like you have a lot to choose from. So.
Well, I think the most important is that I'm most proud that we realized the vision of the mm-hmm. founders. They wanted to see this organization be in existence and truly reduce the harm of tobacco. And we did. Attorney General Skip Humphrey, Dr. Richard Hurt, who, you know, a doctor at Mayo Clinic, and he was a board chair for the first 4 years. Many of the founding board members who came on, and Dr. Siebert Koop and Dr. David Kessler, All of them had this vision that this organization would be able to fund and impact the life and culture in Minnesota, that it changed and reduced the harm. And to me, that's what we're able to do. Thanks to the board members throughout the years, the staff members throughout the years, our partners and grantees, we saw Minnesota become a healthier place.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it could have gone, it didn't have to go that way. And the fact that you were able to lead it to.
Right.
Very
yes.
impressive.
Well, and there are many states who their money, their settlement dollars went to roads and bridges.
Exactly.
Or I remember Ohio, they had a $215 million budget for their tobacco control, and they had a downfall. And, you know, the governor took that $215 million and developed a jobs program.
Yeah.
Now, it's great for the jobs program, but it completely wiped out what changes they could have done
exactly.
in the health-related areas, especially around tobacco.
Exactly. Do you know, you mentioned Oklahoma, do you know if they're still in existence?
Oh, yes, they're okay. in existence, but the legislature has found a way, because they ended up having more and more money, and it just kept ballooning, and so they started funding other programs, as not just tobacco.
Oh.
And then the legislature found a way to, I believe they've now found a way to augment that.
I see.
Yeah, you know, to keep from all that money keep going into, you know, just that one fund. But it took them a while. But Oklahoma is one of the states that still does have a program that's functioning.
Okay. Perfect. What do you believe is the future of the tobacco control movement? It's a broad question.
Well, first of all, one of the most exciting things that just happened is in May 17, the tobacco settlement that was announced between the Attorney General and JUUL. And I actually attended that. And as I mentioned earlier, one of my colleagues and I, we were deposed by the state and JUUL for that trial. And the state took it to trial, and then they announced. And so the thing that is so exciting for me is that May 17th, I went to the governor's office and the attorney general's, you know, well, they had, it was the governor and attorney general had a press conference. They announced that the state of Minnesota received $60.5 million in their settlement from JUUL and Altria, and that 60% of the funds will be received in the first year. The legislature created a special fund for that money to go.
Okay.
And the settlement funds will go to that special area, that special fund they created, to be administered by the Department of Health. The funds are dedicated to prevent youth smoking and e-cigarette use.
Wow.
So that, I mean, I got the answer to your question, you know, it just last month. Which is, I think, is so exciting, because now this, as the money gets here, so it'll take the health department. They said it'll take them about, I mean, the money's going to come in this year.
Okay.
And so I think this year and probably next year, I think about, it'll take the health department about 2 years or so to gear up to be able to start putting out grants and RFPs.
Okay.
But basically, the health department now has $60.5 million to use to address youth smoking and vaping.
Thank goodness.
So, I mean, that is just so exciting that, you know, this can continue, the kind of work that we did can continue as well. You know, I think the key is going to be to guard so that nobody rips that money off.
Exactly, because it's not protected in the same way.
I don't believe it is, but... Again, you know, this governor and this attorney general have said they will protect it, obviously.
Okay.
But again, this is the exciting thing, is that there's new money, great amount of money to, again, help fund youth prevention in both smoking and vaping.
Wow. So it's a positive outlook, then, you'd say, for...
Yeah, I think there's a very... I mean, first of all, the fact that... I mean, everybody kept asking us, why are you going out of existence? Because vaping is coming up just as you guys are going out of existence.
Yeah.
And of course, then states and attorney general across the country started suing JUUL, and they started settling. And so our hope was, this was our hope, that, you know, there would be a good settlement, and then the money would then again be set aside to do the kind of work that we did. And so that's why the state wanted us to be deposed, because we talked about all the programs, all the budgets, everything that we did that made a difference. And of course, that was their whole goal. And so now we've seen it just happen, where they announced it, the special fund was created by the legislature, and the money's going to go in. So, I mean, it was just, it was so great to be able to put that little sort of exclamation point at the end. And we, you know, again, it's nothing we did as Clearway in that sense, but it, being able to have a part in it and see it actually happen is just so rewarding.
Wow.
And other states across the country also, again, they sue JUUL. Now, I don't know how many states are setting aside money again.
Okay.
This is part of the problem, is when you get settlements like that, a lot of times the money then is, it supposedly it's supposed to go, but if it doesn't get designated and it doesn't by, you know, the legislature, the governor, or somehow, then eventually it gets used somewhere else. Now, the thing that the Minnesota settlement does is that JUUL cannot I mean, that's part of the settlement. They can't advertise anymore in the state of Minnesota to youth and young people. In fact, any of the ads that run in Minnesota, the person in the ad has to be over 35.
Wow.
It's that specific.
That's very specific. Oh my gosh.
No, I mean, and if you read the settlement, there's some very interesting things in there. In this settlement, about again trying to prevent Juul, and I think the other thing is I think other vaping, because this is only Juul and Altria, right, but other vaping companies are going to hopefully take note that if they start doing the same thing, you know, the Attorney General is going to come after them. So hopefully it has this kind of an effect. Yeah. Again, like we saw a change in the culture, you know, around vaping. Kids are so addicted. I mean, I don't know how much you know about vaping, but a little vial of Juul has the same nicotine as 20 or a pack of cigarettes.
I did not know that.
Yes. That's why they get so addicted so fast.
Oh my God.
And so that's the thing. They're getting addicted to nicotine. And they're having withdrawal from nicotine when they actually have to get off.
Oh my gosh.
And so trying to help kids that, and so it just becomes, you know, a habit. And then they've got to have these, you know, so you have to have good quit programs. You have to help them with this. Two young ladies, I'm not sure. I think probably they were in high school when the lawsuit started. They may be in college now, but they were with the Attorney General when he filed the lawsuit. They stood beside him, and then they were at the press conference. You know, and one of them talked about she was so addicted, and that's why when she quit, she knew she had to. You know, she wanted to support the lawsuit because she knew how addicting it was to her and her friends.
Exactly. It's just so frustrating to read about this happening, like, you know, all the people getting addicted now when you just went through this whole...
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. But, no, that's amazing news, and
and it was thrilling for us to be able to see that happen. And, of course, I was like, okay, how am I going to answer this question? And then I just got all this good news.
There you go. Perfect. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I guess I kind of... answers most of my questions.
Okay.
Is there anything else that I left out that you have that you wanted to?
No, I thought you did a great job in developing these questions. I feel like we did cover a lot of the things. I mean, I could my wife and others will tell you I could talk about it all day, but I know this is supposed to be something that's concise and people will want to listen to. So thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's been great to work with you, and I appreciate the opportunity of sharing all of this. I think I look forward to seeing it as part of, you know, the History Center and their programs there. So, I'm excited about it.
Well, thank you again. This has been just amazing to hear all of this. You have so many, you're just everything was amazing. Thank you.
Great.
Great.